my feet. Again, it's okay to feel angry, Embat, but you're going to have to learn to deal with it. We're soldiers. We have responsibilities that are bigger than any one individual. So being friends doesn't mean I won't someday have to leave you behind again.
What does it mean to be friends, then?
It means, I said, that if something like that does have to happen, I'll do whatever I can to return to you once the crisis is over. And you'd do the same for me, right, bud?
Yes, he said, hovering higher. Yes, because I can move on my own now.
He turned, looking toward Chet.
And maybe you're right about him, too. Maybe it doesn't matter what he thinks. It's hard to feel that, but I can say it. That feels like a different kind of lying, one that's not all untrue.
We'll make a human out of you yet.
Please, no, he said. From what I've read of it, I really don't want a sense of smell.
I smiled, intending to check on Chet. I hesitated, however, as I saw we'd drifted closer to the fragment with the waterfall. We weren't going to hit it. In fact, our current fragment seemed to have slowed to a normal speed. Serene and peaceful, as if it hadn't just been in a horrific collision. Something was standing on the edge of that other fragment, near the waterfall. I couldn't make out much because of the distance, but it seemed to have glowing white eyes. I felt a mind pushing against mine.
What did you do to the us?
I backed up a few steps. The Delvers had found me. Chet had said it was possible to hide in the belt out here, but I supposed that in using my powers to initiate the vision on the path, I'd drawn their attention. Determined not to be intimidated, I quested out with my own cytonic senses, and I found strength. I'd grown here in the nowhere. I was able to brush that distant Delver's mind as it projected anger at me. I picked out things it didn't intend to broadcast. They had indeed sensed what I'd done in activating the Path of Elders, and they'd sent the battleship fragment to destroy the one I'd been on. That had taken a remarkable amount of effort and was something they couldn't do often. It had actually been an experiment, as they felt they needed to push farther into the belt to try to find and stop me. These glowing-eyed things were the same, an experiment. Isolated individuals who had lost a lot of their memories were susceptible to the Delver's touch, but only non-cytonics for this particular thing they were trying. Saints, I felt so much more in control now, even after only one step on the Path of Elders. The experience had opened something in my brain, showing me how to hide and not draw attention while spying with my cytonics. This Delver still wasn't aware of how much I'd gleaned from it. I felt like gloating, but then I sensed it trying to attack my mind. That manifested as coldness and pressure. It was as if I'd been plunged into an icy lake, the cold seeping like water through my skin, toward my heart. And those voices. What have you done? To the us. To the us. The us referred again to the Delver I'd changed. The others were angry, furious at me, because I'd touched and spoken to that one Delver I'd persuaded not to attack Starsight. In doing so, I'd corrupted it forever, essentially destroying one of their kind. That made me feel sick. The friendly Delver and I had connected in a beautiful way. I'd thought my actions would change things. But if the others refused to listen to me, I shivered as our fragment drifted farther from the one with the waterfall. Chet stepped up next to me then and jarred me from my thoughts.
You felt it too, I presume.
The Delvers possessed someone over there, I said. Chet nodded.
Whatever we did with the path attracted their attention, he said. I find it amazing they'd risk individuality by entering the belt, but it is obviously happening. We will need to be careful moving forward.
Agreed. I took a deep breath. You finished planning our route?
I did indeed, Miss Nightshade, he said, a twinkle in his eye. Tell me, what is your opinion on sailing?
Chapter 14.
Chet led me back to the small wooden building I'd discovered, saying that we needed to salvage some supplies. I tried explaining that it had been picked clean, but once we arrived, he proceeded to take the doors off their hinges. We each carried a door to the edge of the fragment, where we waited an hour to jump across to the next approaching fragment. It was a tropical one, full of tall trees with bare trunks and leaves only at the tops. We took our time crossing this one, scavenging for some strange, oversized nuts the size of a person's head. They weren't coconuts. I knew those from my studies on old Earth, but were similar. We spent the evening hollowing the nuts out by prying off the tops and pulling out the long, stringy pulp by hand. Afterward, we stretched the interior membrane of each one over the hole we'd made and set it to dry. That night, I again failed at contacting Jorgen. But I woke up eager and excited for the day's trek, because while we'd slept, our next fragment had approached. An ocean. It was the most bizarre thing I'd seen here yet. The sides were stone, like the bottom, but they were only about a meter thick. Beyond was water. Essentially, the fragment was an enormous bowl. It seemed larger than most fragments we traveled on, extending for kilometers into the distance. Chet showed me how to use the pulp, which had become cord-like as it dried, to tie the doors together and lash the hollowed-out nuts to them. The nuts were watertight and filled with air, so when we shoved off into the ocean, we had a functional raft. It was awesome. Even Embot was impressed. He buzzed around us, complimenting the raft's structural integrity and remarkable buoyancy. We named the ship the Nautilus, and I stood proudly at the prow. Well, the flat front end I declared the prow. Chet chuckled softly, weaving oars from bent reeds and leftover nut guts. It was slow going, but I still felt like I was some ancient Polynesian hero sailing the ocean for the first time. Plus, it got even better, because the ocean had sea monsters. I saw them swimming below as sinuous shapes and immediately fell to my knees, worried and excited because, you know, sea monsters. I glanced at Chet, who was whistling softly and braiding some nut guts into a stronger cord. One did not act so cheekily nonchalant by accident. He wasn't worried about the sea monsters, whatever they were. "Oh," Embot said, hovering past me. "Look, turn around, about face, reverse rudder or whatever. We're going to get eaten." Chet calmly tossed me the rope, one end of which he'd fashioned into a loop. Then he handed me a small red fruit he'd harvested somewhere. "Float that out beside us," he said. "Then set the loop around it in the water and get ready to pull." I could hardly contain myself as I did what he said. I stood at the ready as a blue serpentine head came up and snatched the fruit. I yanked with a mighty pull, looping the thing around the neck, which let out a gaping yawn? Well, it was a sea monster, even if it barely noticed that I'd captured it. Instead, it chewed on the fruit, bringing up another coil of its body from the depths below. It was like a snake, perhaps as thick as a man's thigh, but had little flippered legs along its very long body. It bit happily at the fruit, then looked up at me with pleading eyes, its head wagging in the water. "You," I told it, "shall be known as Nash the Slaughterer." It made a bubbling sound, then turned eagerly as Chet tossed another fruit far out into the ocean. It began moving, towing us along as I yelped and held tight to the rope. "Spensa," Embot said, hovering along beside my head. "I don't think that creature is likely to slaughter anything." "It's a Garqua," Chet explained, settling back down on the raft, or the deck of our mighty ship. "They're not dangerous. They come from Monrome." "Monrome?" I asked. "Dione homeworld," Chet said. "Even I know that, and I've forgotten the names of my parents." At my blank stare, he continued. "No predators on Monrome." "What?" I said. "None?" "None," Chet said. "Scavengers and herbivores only." I glanced at Embot, who bobbed in the air to simulate nodding. "It's true," he said, "though I doubt this one came directly from the Dione homeworld.
They have colonized nearly 100 planets and have a habit of importing their local wildlife after, exterminating the local species for being too brutal and aggressive. Sounds like them, I said. Still feels odd to me. Did you assume every planet had the same ecological hierarchy as Earth? M'Bot asked. Well, yeah, I said. I mean, it seems pretty fundamental. Things eat other things. It seems fundamental, Chet said, because it's the way it was for us. Doesn't mean it has to be that way everywhere. Huh. I continued holding Nash's leash. She stopped to eat the fruit Chet had thrown, but then continued on, pulling us along contentedly. She appeared to think she'd find another piece of fruit if she kept going that direction, something Chet reinforced by occasionally tossing out another. I contemplated the idea of a world, well, many worlds, if M'Bot was right, without predators. No hunting, no killing. How did survival of the fittest and all that work? At any rate, no wonder the Dionnes thought everyone else was too aggressive. The more I thought about it, though, the more annoyed I became at them. They acted like they were superior, like they'd developed prime intelligence or whatever, because their society was peaceful. But they'd simply evolved on a planet without predators. They hadn't become enlightened or learned a better way. They merely assumed their way was how it was meant to be. I supposed lots of species were like that, my own included. But we weren't conquering the galaxy, currently, or forcing everyone to live by our rules. Currently. We spent the better part of the day crossing the ocean fragment. When we reached the far side, we thanked Nash with some more fruit and then moved on. And let it be known that M'Bot was totally wrong. Nash was an excellent slaughterer, at least when it came to fruit. We slept that night on a fragment with many caves that reminded me of home, and I think I got my best sleep of the entire trip there, comforted by the peaceful sound of water echoing as it dripped. The next day was full of different delights. Cliffs to scale, two swamps with utterly different scents. Really, one smelled like cinnamon, like someone I'd known once. After that, we crossed a fragment broken by winding canyons and beautiful patterns of colored stone. By the end of the day, Chet informed me that we were nearing the Broadsider pirate base, and I found myself strangely melancholy. Once we got a ship, we would travel faster, and I was eager to take to the sky, but I had truly enjoyed the time I'd spent traveling. Flying the rest of the way, well, it seemed that would undermine the epic nature of my quest a tad. That said, as I considered, I decided that many of the heroes from the stories would have used a starfighter if one had been available. Gilgamesh, for example, would totally have done it. Not sure about Shenzong, admittedly. He'd probably have been all about the need for the journey to refine him or some other super-wise Zen stuff. We ended the day on a jungle fragment that I liked more than the first one I'd been on. It had less underbrush, and all the plants were blue, which I found relaxing. It was just a more natural color. According to Chet, this fragment would pass the pirate base the next day. So we decided to camp, and he sent M'Bot to scan for life forms that could be dangerous. I doubt that there are large beasts on this fragment, Chet explained to the AI. But it is better to be careful than to be eaten. Plus, I added, if the Delvers can possess bodies, they might be able to grab one we don't expect. So, see what kind of life there is, big or small. I'd rather not be surprised by a group of zombie chipmunks. Zombie chipmunks, Chet said. It would likely be a fun fight, I said, with lots of kicking. Probably feels about the same to kick a chipmunk as it does to kick a rat. And how many rats have you kicked, Miss Nightshade? Only the ones that were asking for it, I said, smacking my fist into my palm. M'Bot zipped off, and Chet and I began pulling down blue fronds and making bedding out of them. I kind of wished we could make a fire like in the stories, but it never felt cold in here, or hot, plus the smoke would give us away. Soon we each had a nice bed, and though I'd liked the caverns, this was probably going to be the softest of our nights in the nowhere. Thank you, I said to Chet as I settled into mine, for all of this. I've been paid each day,
he said. You don't need to thank me.
And each day, he'd watched the reality icon with hunger. But I moved past that.
You haven't just guided me, Chet. You've taught me and shown me incredible things.
Well, he said, at the very least, I'm glad you were able to see an ocean of sorts. I did promise you they were fun to explore. Regardless, no need to thank me. You saved my life on that fragment that was being destroyed.
And you saved mine.
A sign that we're an excellent team, he said, settling back into his nest of fronds.
More solemnly, he continued,
truly, Miss Nightshade, I've rarely had such an invigorating companion. Plus, you encouraged me toward a goal I've been avoiding for far too long. For that, I thank you.
I nodded in agreement. What are we likely to face tomorrow? Will the pirates be armed with modern weapons, for example?
Yes, he said. But remember, they are mostly outcasts, not a true military force. They have gathered together more out of necessity, to be near other minds.
Any idea why that helps us not forget in here? I asked.
It is curious, isn't it? It's like people are all a little more real when they're together. Maybe together we remind one another what it is to be alive, to have family.
He said that last word with a hint of longing, looking upward through the trees. He'd forgotten his family, whoever they had been. I wished that he could see Embot as a lost friend, reunited, and not an abomination. But I decided not to bring the issue up again at the moment. We fell silent for a while, then Chet spoke, his voice softer.
I once had a ship in here. I decided to fly it all the way to the Lightburst, to get out that way if I could, and return to whatever life I'd left behind. But I lost myself, flying. I think that's when I finally lost the last of my memories of my family, you see. Out there on your own, you don't have anything to remind you of who you are. Down on the fragments, everything, the stones, the structures, the trees, helps somehow. It grounds us, one might say. Ha! At any rate, I think we two will be fine flying together. We'll have each other, plus your icon. It should be enough. Should be.
Chet trailed off and I shivered, imagining losing so much. I had to stay focused. Find my answers and get home. It had been how long since I'd entered the nowhere? Maybe a week? How many times have I slept, I wondered. 3? Or has it been 4? It was unnerving that I couldn't remember, so I focused on the upcoming mission. We'll send Embot to do some reconnaissance once we're on the pirate faction's fragment, I told Chet. They may not be a true military, but they've got to be somewhat competent to have stolen ships and kept them.
That is true, Chet said. I agree. Expect them to be modestly capable, but not military trained.
I'll bet they sleep in shifts and have scouts on duty to watch for anyone approaching, even on foot. So we have 2 options, as I see it. The first is to hit them when most of their numbers are away during a fight. During a battle, the people they leave behind might be distracted enough for us to get in and steal a ship.
Assuming all the ships aren't away at the fight, he said, denying us our opportunity for larceny.
I suspect they'll be smart enough to leave reserves. And if not, there will be ships in their hangars undergoing maintenance. Embot should be able to determine which of them are in flying shape.
Still sounds dangerous, Chet said, leaning back in his makeshift bed. I assume they would be more alert during a fight, not less.
Well, our second option is to strike during a long shift when most of them are asleep. We move in stealthily, have Embot hack through a ship's security, then fly out with our prize before anyone knows what's happening.
They'll give chase, Chet noted.
Trust me, Chet, I said. I might not know how to build a raft, but I won't have trouble outflying anyone in that group.
Marvelous! I shall look forward to our flight then.
Embot came zipping back.
I used infrared scanners to search for warm life forms and didn't find anything larger than a worm, he announced. No chipmunks, zombified or otherwise.
Thanks, I said.
That wasn't a made you look joke, was it? He asked. Sending me out to look for things? I can't tell.
I'd completely forgotten about pranking him that once, so it took me a moment to remember what he was referencing. No joke, I promised him. We really did want you to look for dangers on this fragment. Thanks, he said, then flew off again, likely to begin searching for mushrooms. I sat there for a while, staring upward. Then I jumped when M-Bot returned. How long had I just been sitting there, not noticing the passage of time? Chet was already asleep. I couldn't tell. It could have been a minute, could have been an hour. But M-Bot had 7 different mushroom samples in his grabber claws and was laying them out to catalog them, so scud. I turned over in my bed, worried about that sudden passage of time. Gran-Gran had told me about a man who'd accidentally slept for hundreds of years. That wouldn't happen to me, would it? Normally, a thought like that might have kept me awake. But this time, I fell right to sleep. Interlude. Floating. I quested out, searching as I had before. Like on other nights, I didn't find anything. I was nearly pulled down by my own tiredness again. But no, I was defiant. Plus, I was better with my powers than I'd ever been. I was stronger than sleep, stronger than my own worst instincts, strong enough to push through. I latched onto the familiar sensation of Jorgen's mind and pulled myself toward it. This time, I interrupted him shaving. He jumped as he saw me suddenly reflected in his mirror, standing beside him in the lavish bathroom. It had 2 sinks. He was wearing a towel, fortunately, but I do have to say, boy took care of himself. Mandatory PT for pilots didn't give a fellow pecs like that, not without some extra reps at the gym. Spin, he snapped. This is not a good time. Oh, and last time was better? I said, folding my arms and refusing to be embarrassed. At least you're not getting shot at. He reached for his towel to wipe away the shaving suds covering half his face, then, wisely, stopped. Finally, he took a deep breath. Sorry, he said. I didn't mean to snap at you. You certainly couldn't have known you'd find me in a compromising position.
Huh, I said. How do you do that?
What?
Stay calm, I said. Be so understanding.
Command training.
Bull, I said. I know your secret, Jorgen Wait. You're a good person.
That's a secret?
Hush, I said. I have to say things like that, or I'll look like an idiot for taking so long to figure it out. It would help me out a ton if you'd at least pretend to be an actual jerkface now and then.
I'll work on that,
he said, smiling. I stepped forward, then edged around him so I could stand between him and the sink. He could only see me in the reflection, so if I stood there, facing the mirror, our height difference meant we could look each other in the eyes. He stepped back to give me room. Saints, that smile was adorable with half his face shaved. Even the tiny scabs from his healing cuts were adorable, in a grizzled warrior kind of way. I, however, was anything but adorable. I'd never been one to fret over my appearance. Even when I tried during my school days, kids used to joke that I looked like a rodent. They felt so brilliant realizing that the rat girl was a bit mousy. That said, scud. I need to find a hairbrush, don't I? I said. And a shower. Or 7.
You look just fine.
Ah, just fine. Exactly what a woman loves to hear.
I'm sorry, he said. I meant to say that you look like a barbarian who just finished killing her 17th rabid tiger to make a necklace out of their incisors.
Really? I said, tearing up. I mean, it was silly, but, you know, he was trying.
It's like you came strolling directly out of a barbarian story, he said, except for the jumpsuit.
I can fix that, I said, reaching for the zipper. The way his eyes bulged was totally worth it. But he looked so uncomfortable that I spun around to face him, raising my hands. Joking. I'm joking, Jorgen. Don't faint or anything. He shook his head, reaching for a washcloth to wipe the suds from his face. That left his face half covered with black stubble, which would have been sexy except, you know, the fact that it was only half the face. I turned back around toward the mirror. "What happened to your face anyway?" I asked. Jorgen grimaced.
"I squeezed a slug. It didn't appreciate it and let me know."
I wanted more details, but I knew our time was short, so I didn't press him.
"I lied earlier, Spencer," he said. "Command training did not prepare me for you. Nothing could have done that. Anyway, I suppose I should ask for a report."
"Days passed?" I asked him.
"Since our last visit? 5.
Yeah, time was odd in the nowhere. I thought it had only been 3 for me, but I couldn't tell for certain. "I've made progress on my quest," I explained. "I'll tell you about that in a minute, but first I have more important intel. Jorgen, I think the superiority leaders are trying to make a deal with the Delvers. An alliance." He blinked, then took a deep breath.
"That's unfortunate."
"That's all you can say?"
"I was taught not to curse in front of a lady."
"Good thing there are none of those here, eh?" He smiled.
"You say you think they'll make a deal. They haven't yet?"
"Not that I know," I said. But the Delvers were intrigued by what Winzik said, and judging by what I felt from them, I think it will happen, unless we find a way to stop it.
"I'll report this to Cobb and the command staff," he said. "It confirms our worst fears, that the Delver summoning wasn't an anomaly, but an appetizer. Anything else?"
"I found a kind of heritage site," I said. "It's hard to explain, but I saw some of the history of cytonics and was taught a little how to better use my abilities. Jorgen, I'm pretty sure we were made when the nowhere leaked into our reality and changed people living nearby."
"Changed?"
"Think of it like a mutation," I said, "caused by specialized radiation seeping through weak spots between dimensions. It means we're not freaks. We're mutations."
"Well,"
he said, rubbing his chin in thought,
"though I don't like the word freak, many would call a mutation exactly the sort of thing that makes you one. Certainly a defect could be caused by a mutation. So I'm not sure what you're saying."
"I'm saying that we're not some kind of sleeper agent for the Delvers," I said. "We predate them, in fact. What's happened is that cytonics have blended with the nowhere, giving us access to it, letting us bend our reality to work the way it does." He nodded slowly.
"If what you say is true, then we could potentially make more cytonic people."
"There's a portal," I said, "on Detritus, in the tunnels near Igneous. Search northeast of the cavern, near some old pipes in a place with some strange patterns carved in the stone. You might want to study it."
"I'll put some people on it," he said.
"Be careful," I noted. "A cytonic can fall through and get stuck in here, and it's hard to get out, so don't, you know, pull a Spencer."
"Will do,"
he said, meeting my eyes in the reflection.
"This is important. I'm glad you stayed, even if it means, well, this."
He gestured at my ghostly state. "I'm going to continue on the path," I said. "First, I have to deal with a bunch of pirates, though."
"There are pirates in the nowhere?"
he asked. "Yeah, awesome, isn't it?"
"I thought the place was, well, nothingness."
"Kind of is, kind of isn't," I said. "It's complicated. I'm going to steal a starfighter tomorrow, which should let me get to the next memory dump." He backed up to lean against the wall, his arms folded, thoughtful. And for the first time, I noticed how tired he looked. It was tough to tell with Jorgen, who always seemed so upright and solid, his dark brown skin making it harder to make out signs of fatigue, like bags under his eyes. "Jorgen," I said. "You all right?"
"Things are tense here. We've found a way to protect ourselves. The planet's defenses are fully online, thanks to Rig and the engineers."
"Well, that's good. You're safe."
"Too safe,"
he said.
"The galaxy is collapsing under the control of a tyrant while we're hiding. I know we barely started playing on the galactic stage, but it feels wrong to hide. We should be doing something."
He grimaced.
It's politics, Spencer. You would be indignant if you were here.
You can be indignant on my behalf.
I'm trying, he said, but you know how my parents are. I love them, Spencer, but they're partially responsible. They would have us keep hiding, hoping the enemy will just leave us alone. I know that will never happen. I knew it before you told me about what's happening with the Delvers.
Maybe my news will be enough to get them to listen.
Maybe,
he said, sounding entirely unconvinced. I glanced around at the decor. I'd noticed that this wasn't some standard DDF bunkhouse latrine, but now I saw more. Was that gold on the trim? White marble? Your home, I guessed. Trying to persuade your parents?
I thought maybe they'd listen if I could talk to them outside a formal context. I should have known. They've arranged 4 dinners for me, all with eligible young women from the lower caverns.
The rich caverns, he meant. The ones best protected from surface attacks.
Good thing I'm not the jealous type, I said. Kind of wish you were, he said. If you'd swing by and decapitate one or two of them, maybe the others would give up.
Jorgen, please, I said. Decapitation is reserved for worthy enemies on the battlefield. This coaxed a full-on smile from him. He walked back up to me, and though we couldn't touch, I could feel his mind behind me. And I successfully resisted the urge to probe his mind with my new talents. We stood there, looking, feeling, for a short time, because it was all we had. You know, I finally said, I'm a little surprised to find out you don't shower in your uniform. I half figured there was some outdated rule that required you to wear it at all times, or suffer 1/16th of a demerit.
Wait until someone hears that I had a girl in the bathroom with me, he said.
I'm sure invisible girls don't count, I said, and felt myself start to fade. Take care of yourself, Jorgen.
Same to you, he said. Consider it an order.
I nodded, reaching for him. It felt like I got an armful of something, something that was him, as it all vanished and I was dumped back into the nowhere. His essence, like his scent, lingered, as did the picture of him in my head, half-shaven, weary. Still, this was a success. I'd been able to find him again, and I was more confident in my powers. So confident, in fact, that I did something that might have been stupid. I went looking for the Delvers. Last time I dreamed like this, I'd overheard them engaging in an important conversation. Could I do that again? I quested outward, trying to capture the same sensation as last time. The same location? It was wrong to think of anything in this place as having locations. It was more like frequencies or something slammed into my mind.
It was you, Braid said.
You were watching before. I told Winsick, but he didn't believe me. I tried to pull away, but she was better trained than I was, and she seemed to have some kind of ability to hold on to my mind in a way I'd never experienced before. I was like a fly in a web, buzzing about, but held tight by Braid's own mind.
I knew you were alive, she said. You did escape into the nowhere, didn't you? Little cricket, sneaking about.
Braid, I responded.
You don't have to be like this. You don't have to.
Of course I don't, she said. You know what I hate most about you, Alanik? It's that you aren't willing to admit, even for the shortest moment, that I'm capable of making my own decisions. To you, I'm merely a misguided dupe.
Winsick is going to kill all the Cytonics, I said.
That's the promise he made to the Delvers. You know that. You're the one who communicated the offer. In response, she laughed. She either didn't care or had some plan I didn't understand. And with my improving senses, I could feel a little more. That to her, my complaints were simplistic, perhaps insultingly so. She tried to rip my mind apart. But there was one thing I'd learned by sticking up for myself in the past. Bullies expect you to fold. I leaned into the fight. I didn't whimper or curl up or back away. I threw myself at Braid with everything I had. Though I was formless, just a collection of thoughts, our minds could clash, like 2 bursts of light throwing sparks, 2 stars meeting. She was trained, but I was ferocious. Braid broke first, then fled, leaving me exhausted as I slowly faded into proper dreams, highlighted by half-shaven officers and epic journeys on sailing ships pulled by dragons. Part 3. Chapter 15. Together, Chet and I slipped onto the pirate base fragment. Our touch point was a good half hour from the base, so as we crept closer and closer, Chet showed me how to keep a low profile and stay behind tree or hill cover. We also sent Embot to scout a path for us, telling him to use his infrared to watch for heat signatures that might indicate a sentry. As we crept along, I thought of what I'd seen the previous night. Once again, my interactions with Jorgen and Braid were crisp and clear in my mind, and I'd been a little more in control, a little more active in what I'd been doing. That excited me. I was improving. The terrain here was dotted with scraggly trees that were like stumpy, Spensa-sized analogs to the massive ones from the last jungle fragment. Various boulders and hills made for a poor killing field. I'd have set up my base on a sturdy, flat fragment with minimal cover. Maybe losing one of their ships would teach these pirates a lesson, because getting up close was way too easy. I was getting antsy, eager. If this went well, I'd be flying before the hour was out. Chet and I staked out a tree-topped small hill some 50 meters from the base's buildings. Together, on our bellies, we inched up beneath the trees to where we could see over the top of the hill and study the base. As far as we could tell, we'd been able to approach unnoticed. Unfortunately, we couldn't rule out hidden cameras. It would depend on what the pirates had been able to salvage. So I watched for any signs the pirates were on alert. Their base was made up of three large structures, rectangular with rounded tops, like old-school hangars. It was a nostalgic design, but didn't make much sense with modern starfighters, which were universally VTOL aircraft, thanks to acclivity stone. "Do you suppose they built those structures?" I asked Chet.
"Doubtful," Chet whispered back. "From what I understand, the pirate factions each set up on fragments with pre-existing buildings, old outposts or the like."
"Will this fragment have a portal?"
"It's possible, but unlikely. Most do not, after all."
I nodded, thinking it through. We'd seen how fragments grew. Matter collected around little pinprick weaknesses between dimensions, eventually forming into these landscapes. I didn't know for certain if that matter slipped in from the somewhere or was just replicated here. Did this mean the caverns of detritus had formed because bits of rock had slipped into the nowhere? There was no way to tell right now, but either way, it did seem Chet was right about the portals not being on most fragments. Maybe those only formed on fragments where the holes between dimensions were big enough that cytonics could get through? Well, for now, I needed to keep my mind on stealing a ship. Of the three hangars, two were dark at the moment. The third, the one in the center, had its bay door open wide, and flashes of light inside indicated welding or electrical work going on. I was surprised to see electricity at first. But most modern starfighters had energy-packed power matrices that could last years. Plug one of those in, and you'd be able to power the lights and equipment of a hangar like this.
"My sensors indicate two people keeping watch," Embot whispered from where he hovered at my side. "One at the window directly ahead in the lit hangar, another right inside the bay doors. If they're using electronic surveillance, it's wired, as I don't detect broadcasts on any known frequencies." "They won't broadcast carelessly, Abomination," Chet whispered. "Old habits will prevent them."
"Noted, Wart Eyeball," Embot said.
We sat in silence for a moment.
"Okay," Chet whispered. I have to ask, Wart Eyeball?"
"I was going to call you Wart Face," Embot said, "as humans often append face to insults. But warts are frequently on faces. I instead picked a body part that doesn't usually grow warts, a way of implying your stupidity is irrational to the point of implausibility."
Chet glanced at me. Him being weird does not mean he's an abomination, I whispered.
I was more trying to decide if that insult rated a 1 or a 0,
Chet muttered, looking back at the hangers.
So, Miss Nightshade, how would you like to proceed? I believe your military training supersedes my experience in this instance.
Let me think and observe, I said. I couldn't get a good look at the pirate in the window, but they didn't seem to be keeping a close watch. The other one that M'Bot had noted strolled out into the light, a rifle hanging from his shoulder. To my surprise, he was human and had a patchy beard that hadn't grown in straight. He wore a long overcoat, a t-shirt, jeans, and boots. Oh, and a hat. A nautical hat, like a full-on tricorn. I could barely hold in a thrilled squeal.
What?
Chet whispered, noticing my grin. These ones actually look like pirates.
Indeed, Chet said. Human traditions have had a large influence on populations like these. From what I've been able to gather, our conquest of the galaxy made it trendy, perhaps a little exotic, to use human terms and fashion for outlaws.
He squinted.
That said, I didn't expect to find an actual human among their ranks. Not a lot of us around these days.
The pirate in the window leaned out and called something. They were definitely a Dione, a Rite, judging by their red coloring. Looks like they're doing some repairs, I said. M'Bot, swing around the rear and see if you can get a count on how many people are inside. If it appears safe, hover up to one of those windows and learn what you can about the starfighters.
Understood, he said, and zoomed off.
He was extremely quiet. That was why I'd been able to use the drone for spy missions. I wished we still had the holographic projector to give him some limited camouflage. Fortunately, that guard didn't seem particularly observant. He yawned as he strolled back toward the hangar opening.
Miss Nightshade, Chet said, what we are about to try is much more dangerous than our previous endeavors. That guard is armed, and we risk capture or wounding.
I'm willing to take the risk.
As am I, Chet said. But I feel that we should, out of an abundance of caution, leave your icon behind.
Leave it behind, I said. Why in the stars would we do that?
That icon is one of the most valuable things in the Nowhere, he explained in a hushed tone. If we are captured, I would not want the pirates to gain possession of it. Instead, I feel we should bury it here. If we succeed in claiming a ship, we can return at some future date and recover it. If we fail, then the icon will be safe.
But we need it to fly out there, I said. Without it, we'll lose our memories.
It is the ashes that are important for our immediate travels, Chet said. With a pocket full of those, we can go months without any dangerous effects. And so, we can bring those with us and risk their loss, but keep the much more valuable object hidden.
Scud. There was a logic to his words. If this went wrong, I'd be much happier if my icon was safe. But at the same time, I had seen the way Chet stared at it. I wanted to trust him. I did trust him, but if he wanted to take the icon, then persuading me to bury it here would be a great first step. I wavered. Chet had treated me with nothing but honor so far, but my concerns hovered at the back of my mind. He'd appeared in such an unusual way, specifically when I needed him. M'Bot's old pilot, conveniently missing the memories that could help him prove who he'd been. Hiding the icon is probably a good idea, I said to Chet, so he wouldn't sense my suspicions. I fished out the pouch and made a show of dumping the reality ashes back into my pocket, but I also palmed the pin. Then I buried the pouch as he'd suggested, except empty. Afterward, I handed him a small pinch of ashes. In case we get split up, I told him. He stared at the ashes an uncomfortably long time before tucking them away, and as his attention was on them, I covertly slipped the pin into another pocket. Soon, M'Bot came hovering in from behind.
There are 3 pirates working in the hangar,
he whispered to us, and one other person in an inner room. No other heat signatures in the building.
Right. That made 6 total in that hangar. The guard, the one at the window, the one farther inside, and 3 workers.
There are 10 other heat signatures, Embot whispered. 6 in one hangar building, 4 in the other. I think those are all asleep. At least, their heat signatures indicate recumbent figures in smaller rooms.
Probably divided into 3 flights, I guessed. Each hangar houses a flight, and one group is left on duty to watch every time the others sleep.
Agreed, Embot said. There are 4 starships in the open hangar, and 1 is being worked on by the mechanics. 6 people, 4 pilots, 2 ground crew, maybe?
That sounds likely, I whispered. Any way into that open hangar from behind?
There is a small open door at the rear, Embot said, probably to let air in during the welding.
Awesome, I said. We should strike while the other 2 flights are asleep.
Chet, your job is to make a distraction. Can you do something that isn't so dangerous as to make them sound the alarm, but which has a good chance of drawing the attention of not only the guards, but the 3 mechanics too? Possibly, he said. The broadsiders are known as the most level-headed of the pirate factions. I've encountered other guides or groups who have traded with them, or even been employed by them for a short time. I think it will be safe enough to walk up with some reality ashes and offer to trade.
How likely are they to grab you? I asked. Steal the ashes and enslave you?
It's a distinct possibility, he admitted. But again, I believe it's a worthwhile risk. I don't trust any pirates, but if I were going to approach a faction in this manner, the broadsiders are the ones I'd choose. They should be interested in trading, but will want to keep a good eye, or 10, depending on the species, on me just to be careful.
Let's go with it then, I said. Embot and I will sneak around back. Once you've distracted the pirates, we'll slip into the hangar from behind and hotwire a starfighter.
And you're certain you can accomplish that feat? Chet asked. Well, little in life is absolutely certain, Embot said. But I find it highly unlikely that these pirates have security I can't instantly break. I'd say it's more likely that you spontaneously grow a wart from your eye. You. Wart eye.
I eyed him. Chet's right. That's definitely a 0.
Ready then, Chet said. Let's do this.
Once I have the ship, I said, we'll activate the weapons and force the pirates to lie on the floor. Run for the ship and climb up into the cockpit. We'll escape, and then we can send Embot to sneak back and grab the icon.
An excellent plan, Chet said. When do I make the distraction?
I'll send Embot to signal you when I'm in position. Then count to 100 before you go for it. We shared a nod, and then I withdrew to begin sneaking around to the other side of the base. Chapter 16. The first thing I did was send Embot back to spy on Chet. I buried the pouch for my pin under a rock near the trees, I told him. Covertly watch to see if he digs it up. If he doesn't, stealthily join me behind the pirate base. I'll explain later, I said, and waved him off. He left. My heart thundering in my chest, I continued to sneak around the side of the compound. It was just like creeping up on a rat, only there was more light and these doofs were less observant. I made it to the other side of the compound easily and found a good spot to watch near a large boulder. The hangar had a small, person-sized doorway on this side. Through it, I could clearly see the mechanics working on the landing gear of one of the starfighters, 2 Dions, and 1 of the feathered aliens I'd seen when I first entered the Nowhere. They serviced a narrow, sleek vessel that was probably a scouting model. Sparks flew as they welded. I waited, anxious. I didn't want to be distrustful. Scott, Chet had helped me so much. But I couldn't deny the way he looked at the icon, and it seemed incredibly suspicious that he'd asked me to leave it behind. I nearly yelped when Embot hovered up to me a few minutes later. Stars, he was quiet.
He doesn't appear to be digging at anything, Spencer, Embot whispered. He's just waiting.
Okay, good, I said, relaxing.
Do you think he's going to betray us?
I don't want to think that, I said, but I can't help being suspicious. I tried so hard to trust Braid, and where had that gotten me?
Go tell him I'm in position. He can start with the distraction.
Embot zipped off again. I took a few deep breaths to calm myself. My worry was unfounded. Unless, if I'd been planning to betray my companion, I wouldn't merely steal the pin. I'd do something to disrupt the plan, making certain she got captured by the pirates. That way, I wouldn't have to worry about her following me as I made off with the prize. Scud. Now that I'd thought of it, I couldn't get it out of my head. If Chet simply grabbed the icon and ran, I could conceivably steal the ship and come after him. But if he waited until I was in the middle of the theft, then sold me out, he could keep the icon while making sure I was taken care of. Again, I didn't want to believe it. I almost discarded the worry entirely. But then I thought about the way he changed whenever he saw the icon. And what were the chances that I'd enter the nowhere and immediately find Commander Spears? While I didn't actually think some kind of evil wizard was involved, that was more a metaphor, something was seriously strange about all of this. I couldn't help feeling I was being toyed with, and Chet was at the center of it. I made a snap decision. I wouldn't abandon the plan, but neither would I walk straight into a potential trap. First, I pulled out my father's pin, then dug a quick hole beside my boulder. Embot came hovering back as I was finishing.
I thought you already buried that, he said.
I buried the pouch, but kept the pin, I explained. I'm worried Chet is going to betray us, and this is the best way I can think of to protect the pin in case we get captured. I felt oddly reluctant to part with it, like it almost seemed to cling to my fingers as I put it in the hole. I couldn't help thinking it was sad to have me abandon it. This place was messing with me in strange ways. The mechanics in the hangar stood up and looked out toward where Chet had been hiding. Distraction begun.
So what do we do?
Embot whispered. In case my worries are correct, we're not going to steal the ship Chet assumes we will. Which of those other hangars has the fewest sleeping people?
The one directly to the right, he said. It only has four, but Spencer, are you sure about this?
It's not my job to be sure, I said. It's my job to do my best anyway.
Come on.
We slipped out from behind cover and reached the hangar easily. Sneaking around on dirt and grass was simple, just had to test each step for leaves or twigs. The doors were locked, but one of the nearby windows was unlatched. Embot was able to slip in, and a moment later, the door into the left side of the structure, the part with bunks rather than the ship storage, clicked. I eased it open, then stepped into a dark hallway. The place had a clinical feel to it, like the hallways of Platform Prime. Too clean, and it smelled sterile. The doorways were all taller and thinner than the ones at home, and the door handles were all a good half meter higher than I expected. It left me imagining what kind of species had built this place. In the dim light, I located a door into what I thought should be the hangar proper. Embot bobbed up and down, no heat signatures beyond it. This door was unlocked, and I was relieved to find a vast, cavernous room. Light shone through slits in the window shades, illuminating four large starships like slumbering leviathans. It was one of the most beautiful sights I'd ever encountered. I whispered for Embot to watch for junk I might accidentally kick while walking. Didn't want to send a discarded lubricant can clanging across the floor. As I crept along the wall, I stopped by one of the windows to peek out through the slats. I could clearly see Chet standing outside the other hangar, surrounded by the guard and mechanics. He spoke animatedly while carefully holding up a reality ash in one hand.
Spencer, Embot whispered, it doesn't seem like he's betraying us.
It didn't. But, well, that was why I'd continued with the plan. If I really was just being paranoid, then I could still steal a ship, break out, and turn guns on the pirates while Chet joined me. I'd tell him I'd been spooked at the last minute and had decided to sneak into a building where everyone was asleep. I turned from the window to survey the four fighters. Two were obviously civilian ships augmented with some makeshift destructors that marred the otherwise intentional designs. Fortunately, the two others were military, with built-in weapons. I picked the Interceptor, a lean, dangerous-looking variety of ship that balanced speed and offensive capabilities. It also felt the most familiar, similar to DDF ships from Detritus, with a long, thin arrow shape. I hurried over and grabbed the wing, then hauled myself up to the canopy. I was acquainted at this point with several different control schemes. I'd have to hope that I knew this one's. If not, I'd inspect the other ships. Stars. I hoped I didn't have to end up stealing that shuttlecraft in the corner. Piloting that would be like riding a pot-bellied pig into battle among a group of knights. I peered into the cockpit of the ship, and it was dark and shadowed, so I couldn't identify the control scheme from outside. I felt along the rim and found an access port for MBOT. Most ships had external ones for diagnostics. I plugged in his drone to let him interface, which would theoretically allow him to open the cockpit and override the pilot lockouts. "Ah," MBOT said, "this will be easy. Lots of hard drive space in here. It might feel nice to be in a larger ship again. First, though, let's see. Should be through in 30 seconds or so." I nodded, leaning down and staring into the cockpit. That was a control sphere, wasn't it? Yeah. The layout did seem familiar. The seat was strange and lumpy, though. Like instead of being a chair, it was some other seating mechanism. Thinking about that started me worrying about the Kitsen, who had their own strange way of building starships. They'd helped me at the battle against Starsight. What would Winzik do to them? They were leaderless now that Hesho was dead, sucked out into the vacuum of space when Braid attacked their ship. The Kitsen had trusted me. Had I doomed their entire planet? What happened if Winzik actually persuaded the Delvers to help him? I needed to find some way to stop them, so... "Huh," MBOT said. "What?" I hissed. "I just got locked out of a few systems," he said. "I can reroute, but that's odd. The lockout was via a manual override. How would..." Lights went on in the cockpit, illuminating a creature that had been sleeping inside. The light reflected off a body that I had trouble sorting out, crystalline limbs and a bulky shape like a pile of glistening stone. "Oh, Scud," I whispered. No heat signatures. But not all life was warm. I knew that. Figments like vapor seemed not to even have bodies. I'd made a terrible miscalculation. My sole consolation was that MBOT had done the same. "MBOT," I said, "run!" I leaped off the wing and hit the ground hard, stumbling as a loud alarm started blaring. I made it halfway to the door before a voice sounded over some speakers.
"Keep running, and I will vaporize you," it said,
my translator pin happily supplying the words in English. I froze, then looked back at the ship to find one of the wing-mounted destructors on a turret pointing right at me. I raised my hands, struggling to catch my breath and fighting down my instinct to run. Looked like I was going to get another chance at being a pirate captive. And this time, it was entirely my own fault. Chapter 17. The pirates thumped me down in a seat, and one of them lashed my hands behind me. A large group of them had gathered in the hangar, which was now flooded with light. I saw only one human among them, the fellow I'd noticed earlier. Most of the rest were Dione's, though there were also several of those bird people, and one Varvax, the alien species I'd known as the Krell, small crab-like creatures that moved around in large, blocky exoskeleton suits built from something like sandstone. The group parted to make way for an alien of a completely different race, with a wide face and powerful limbs. Long teeth and clawed fingers gave this one the overall appearance of something like a bear on its hind legs, except not furry. They walked with a hunched forward gait, giving them a predatory air, beefy arms held forward and at the ready. I took this one for the leader of the group, considering the fine jacket and impressive hat, complete with a large plume.
"Words," the creature said. "Trying to steal a starfighter, eh? You must have grown at least 6 mullens for trying that."
My pin didn't translate the word, which was odd. I sat there, my hands bound behind me, and tried to come up with a plan. The leader alien walked up and slapped me on the back in a way that felt distinctly friendly.
"But you have rotten luck," the leader continued. "Not a single gullin for you. Picking a ship inhabited by one of our resonants? Words, girl, words! Anyway, welcome to the Broadsiders."
"Wait," I said, twisting to look at the leader.
"Welcome?"
"The more people we have around, the more stable our memories remain," one of the Dione's explained. "So you're lucky. No execution for you. Instead, you get to be our new cleaning slave."
Great. Well, as awful as being a slave sounded, I felt even worse for messing up the plan. Chet had been trustworthy all along, and here I'd bungled everything.
"There were some ashes on her, Captain,"
the Varvax noted in their language, holding up a glowing, transparent bag. The scruffy human stepped forward, carrying Embot's drone.
"Ma'am, this is what she used to try to break into the starship."
I felt a spike of alarm. Embot? The drone seemed completely lifeless. The human fiddled with it, then found the old power button, which Embot had disconnected. However, when the human pushed the button, the drone's small acclivity rings powered on, turning from dull blue-black to a vibrant glowing azure. The drone began to hover on its own power. Then, as the human let go, it hovered over to use its grabber arm to pick up a rag from the floor. It then began wiping a window with it.
"Embot, you genius," I thought.
He always talked about how intelligent he was, but considering how he acted a lot of the time, it was easy to forget. Right now, though, he did a spot-on imitation of a cleaning drone.
"Huh,"
the captain said, then nudged me, hard enough that my chair scooted along the floor.
"How'd you make it hack the canopy on Shiver's starfighter?"
"It has some illegal programs," I muttered, trying to play the role of the mousy little rat catcher girl. "I managed to install them before coming in here. Thought it would be smart to hide them in a normal cleaning drone." That would imply the drone didn't have a proper AI, so theoretically, the Broadsiders shouldn't be afraid of it becoming self-aware. Though, admittedly, I didn't know a ton about AIs.
"Is that so?" the captain said. "Words! That might be useful. I'll consider it an apology gift from you for waking me up in the middle of the night. Grow a tullin or two at my generosity, new slave. What's your name?"
"Spin," I said. "Yours?"
"Ha! Mullins, indeed."
She swept off her hat and inclined her head toward me, revealing a crest of yellow feathers like a mohawk.
"I'm Peg, captain of the Broadsiders."
"Peg?" I said, glancing at the captain's legs, both of which were whole. "As in..." The human laughed.
"Nah," he said to me in heavily accented English. "She doesn't get it. The name's a coincidence."
He walked over and shut off Embot, who dutifully powered down the rings and stopped moving. I twisted, trying to glance out the window to where Chet had been standing earlier, but couldn't make anything out.
"Your friend ran off,"
the human said to me, then patted the rifle over his shoulder.
"Lucky for him, I was more worried about an attack than I was a scout. I only got a few shots off on him before ducking in to see what was happening."
"Your friend abandoned you," Peg said. "Should have given him some of your mullens."
That about proved it. Chet hadn't sold me out. He'd run, yes, but that was smart. Scud, I felt like a complete idiot. Maybe after being betrayed by Braid, I was overly sensitive. Or maybe I was just a terrible judge of people. Yeah, it was probably that. I had to face it, didn't I? I'd spent most of my training assuming Jorgen was a legitimate jerk, while he was actually pretty unjerky. But I'd tried hard to trust Braid despite the way she acted. I heaved a sigh and tipped my head back to stare at the ceiling. I only wanted to fly again. I'd trained all my life to be a warrior. That was what I knew, what I understood. How did I keep ending up in situations like this instead?
Hey,
Peg said, shoving me on the shoulder.
Don't get like that. You might not realize it, but you're far better off scrubbing our floors than you would be out there on your own.
I squeezed my eyes shut.
Keep her on a leash, Peg said, striding away. And don't let her near that drone, just in case. I'm gonna go back to sleep.
Chapter 18. Leash, it turned out, meant a light line. I'd never seen one used this way. A loop on one end was fastened around my neck, the other end attached to the wall. The control mechanism was locked tight, leaving me stuck. I'd sooner chew through iron links with my teeth than find